Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Reyes, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding. Good morning.
I don't know. Good afternoon. You may have a seat. Thank you. And we have this matter scheduled on a rare Friday for us for oral argument because of the medical emergency counsel for appellant, and all the parties were in agreement to reschedule the matter. And was that you, sir?
It was me.
Well, you look great today, then, based on what we heard. I hope all is well.
It appears to be so far. I'm up and taking nourishment, so that's a good thing.
Excellent. Then I'll note for the record the file number is A220738. I believe it was November 16 we were originally scheduled. And we do ask counsel the usual process, of course. Counsel for appellant will have 15 minutes. We ask that when you approach the podium that you identify yourself for the record. Same for counsel for respondent, which will also have 15 minutes, and then 5 minutes of rebuttal should you choose to accept that. You'll see that you have three options. The best one, I say mainly because of the purpose of the light as well as the up and down, is the middle one, but feel free to use whichever podium you feel most comfortable. So unless there's any questions by anybody, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Your Honors, counsel. My name is Steve Buterin, and I'm here, and I represent appellants David La Liberté and his company, Liberty Construction, in this appeal. I'd like to just first begin by expressing my gratitude and thanks for the court and to the court staff and counsel for allowing this hearing to be rescheduled from its original date because of my unanticipated hospitalization. I know that schedules are full this time of year and that rescheduling can be a challenge, and I believe that's why we're here on a Friday afternoon.
I can represent for the panel there was no hesitation based on the explanation that you gave.
Yes.
Glad to see you today.
Well, I did want to take the opportunity to acknowledge and thank everyone for their understanding, their flexibility, and their hard work in accommodating me. So I'm happy to report that I'm doing well and my recovery is going well, so that's a good thing. So with that, on to the task at hand. I'm here to argue that, to respectfully request that this court reverse the judgment of the district court. The district court erred when it refused to apply the doctrine of qualified immunity to comments made by Mr. La Liberté, and the court abused its discretion when it denied appellant's post-trial motions. First, qualified privilege. The district court erred when it ruled that the doctrine did not apply. The district court erred in two fundamental ways. It applied an incorrect legal standard in determining whether the doctrine should apply, and it didn't analyze the elements of qualified privilege in the context of this case. Now, to understand, qualified privilege applies to otherwise defamatory statements if those statements are made in good faith, on a proper occasion, for a proper purpose, and based on reasonable or probable cause. And the doctrine rests on public policy considerations. And it's a recognition that there are some occasions where it's preferred to allow the statements without the threat of defamation because it outweighs any harm that it may cause the reputation of the person being defamed.
So, counsel, I don't understand why these statements were uttered in the first instance. They seemed to be unsolicited statements. It wasn't like an employer calling for a reference, and it certainly wasn't a statement to a law enforcement official, which are the general contexts in which these kinds of privileges are applied.
Correct, Your Honor. The rationale that was offered, and as the district court acknowledged in its decision, that was Mr. La Liberté considered Mr. Hawkins a friend, and he was simply trying to give him career advice or to warn him of what he perceived as problems with the Hawks. And so it was out of a feeling of, benevolence that he made the statements that he did to Mr. Hawkins so that Mr. Hawkins would be aware of those allegations, and then, as he said, then he advised Mr. Hawkins to do his own research regarding those claims, but he just wanted to raise those for him to consider.
So I take it that you concede that Minnesota has not recognized a qualified privilege for that particular kind of circumstance. I'm wondering if there's any jurisdiction that has, I mean, defamation is a 50-state
correct,
cause of
Your
action.
Honor, and
is
I'll
there
be
any
honest.
Jurisdiction that recognizes a...
To be honest, Your Honor, I don't know, and I didn't. My research wasn't that extensive. I tried to confine it to Minnesota law.
Fair enough.
I think, in response to that, though.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, finish if you had an additional response.
Go ahead.
Well, maybe I'm just dovetailing it. You started out by saying that the court applied the wrong law, an error of law in the analysis. But if, as you just answered Judge Fisher's question, how could that be an error of law if, in fact, it hasn't been recognized under this circumstance to be an available
Right. In her decision, Judge Anderson noted that historically the qualified privilege doctrine applies in the discharge of some public or private duty. But it's not dependent on, the application of the doctrine isn't dependent on the speaker's discharge, making the statements due to some sort of duty, a public duty or a private duty or legal or moral duty, as the cases suggest. Each case that comes before a court must be decided on the facts in that case. The doctrine applies on a case-by-case basis, and it is not dependent on the existence of some sort of duty that governs the speaker. The public policy considerations look to the context in which the statements were made to determine whether the qualified privilege applies.
Well, I'm not sure the Minnesota case law is actually as broad as you're characterizing it there, because the Minnesota Supreme Court has provided limited situations in which that privilege will apply, and I think you acknowledge that it hasn't in this type of scenario, right?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. So are you asking for us to expand the law to include this type of situation?
I don't know if I would say I'm asking you to expand the law, but to look at the law as it stands, in that the policy or the doctrine seems to be driven, the case law suggests that it's driven by the circumstances in which the statements are uttered. And it doesn't turn on whether there's a duty. And if you look at the cases that the court cited in its decision, and maybe I missed it, but it didn't appear that those instances where the doctrine was applied, the statements were made pursuant to any duty. You know, the discharge, the employers were not making the statements because they were forced to due to some duty. So I think the same applies here. There was no duty for Mr. LaLiberte to make the statements that he did. When you evaluate the context of the statements, which the case law again seems to suggest that you must consider the context in which the statements are made, and whether they were made in good faith for a proper purpose on a proper occasion. And if you can demonstrate that, then a prima facie case is established, and then the presumption switches over to the plaintiffs to prove that the privilege was not abused and that it was not made with actual malice.
And counsel, I agree with you there. I think you're fairly citing how it's applied in the particular fact situation, but it seems to me that the Minnesota Supreme Court has said, well, first of all, it has to fit in a situation where qualified immunity would apply in the first place, and if it applies, then we look at those factors to determine in that particular circumstance. And so I'm struggling, because I think our standard of review as an error-correcting court is just to look at what the district court did. The district court said, there's no case law on this that allows me to do that, and it seems to fall more to the Supreme Court or the legislature to include this type of scenario as falling under the qualified immunity exception.
I understand the court's concern, and my response would be that just because there may not be a case that specifically addresses this context, where you have a former employer advising a former employee and or friend of allegations he's heard or become aware of a prospective or current employer, that doesn't limit the application of the doctrine, because again, the doctrine is driven on policy considerations and not duty considerations. And so the court...
But I do think that in the cases where Minnesota courts have extended the qualified privilege, they have done so because the statements should be encouraged despite the fact that there's a risk that the statement could be defamatory. And I wonder if we want to encourage unsolicited statements. That's what happened here. So I think that's where we're falling, right? So why would we want to encourage these kinds of statements, notwithstanding the risk that they might be defamatory?
I think it's important that these statements be allowed because it brings some parity to the employment landscape. Right now, the cards are stacked in favor of employers. They can make these statements without really a concern about them being defamatory. And I think employees are entitled to receive information about prospective or current employers so that they can make the decision of whether they want to continue in the employ of that employer or whether they want to accept a job. And so it helps protect employees from getting into job situations where they may be working for or may wind up working for unsavory or unscrupulous employers. So it's sort of the reverse coin of the cases that discuss that employers we want to encourage the dialogue they have with other employers or what have you about the character or reputation of an employee so that the public is protected from bad employees. Well, I think the converse is that the public is served by ensuring that employees don't wind up they lose the access to information they may have about a prospective employer and wind up working for someone that, like I said, is unscrupulous or unsavory.
Do you see a distinction, counsel, that the fact that here it's unsolicited? I mean, is that consistent with that policy that you're favoring, these sorts of comments should be made even if a prospective employee of that prospective employer doesn't really want my opinion, but I can just send it out?
That's why I think that it's important. In this case, Mr. LaLiberte, I believe, presented a prima facie case during the motions for summary judgment. And then that then gets us into the realm of the rebuttable presumption that then plaintiffs can show that, okay, if the privilege does apply, or if there's been a prima facie case, here's how it's been abused. So there's sort of checks and balances within the application process of the doctrine. The defendant has to present a prima facie case. If he or she does, then the plaintiff then has the obligation to present evidence to rebut that presumption and that the statement was made with actual malice. And whether the privilege was abused, and that's a fact question, whether the privilege was abused.
But is it true, counsel, you don't get to that? Are you referring to malice, or are you referring to the elements of whether it was in good faith or with probable cause?
No, well, it gets to the second phase, the rebuttable presumption portion. So if a defendant presents a prima facie case that, it was... his statements or her statements were made in good faith on a proper purpose, for a proper purpose on a proper occasion, then the plaintiff has to come back and show that the privilege was abused somehow.
But isn't it true we don't get to that? And that's the part of what you're claiming error here, is a court first has to determine as a matter of law whether the privilege applies at all.
Right.
And then then you get to down to those fact-related issues that you're referring to.
And correct, and I think the determination of whether it's solicited or unsolicited comes at the later stage, not in the stage when the defendant raises the defense or the doctrine. There, the courts have looked at simply whether, you know, there's the statement was made in good faith, you know, again, on proper purpose for proper occasion and had a reasonable basis. And once that prima facie case is established, then it's up to the plaintiff to rebut that.
Isn't the fact that it was unsolicited part of the analysis of whether a proper purpose or occasion was present?
I think that gets into questions of fact. And in this case, the matter was decided on summary judgment. So the facts have to be viewed in the light most favorable to Mr. La Liberté and his company. And I think in that case, he presented facts to the court that created a fact issue that with regard to the application of the doctrine. And I think, you know, the unsolicited component goes to the sort of the second half of the equation, so to speak. I see that my time is up, unless the court has any other questions.
Appears not now. You'll have 5 minutes, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for responded. You, when you're ready, you may approach and proceed.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Thomas Boyd here on behalf of respondents Christopher and Stephen Huck. The respondents respectfully ask the court to affirm the district court's judgment in all respects. The district court did not err in declining, and this court should likewise decline appellant's invitation to expand the scope and application of the qualified immunity doctrine to immunize their defamatory statements. Further, the district court did not abuse its discretion in making the various case management decisions that appellants have challenged on appeal. These actions were well within the district court's discretion and authority. They were entirely appropriate, sound, and reasonable under the circumstances, and they did not result in any prejudice to the appellants. For these reasons, there is no error and there is no justification to disturb the final judgment entered in this case. Turning to the qualified immunity issue, here the district court correctly stated the law as to the scope and application of the qualified immunity doctrine as it exists under Minnesota law. The court correctly recognized Minnesota law has not expanded qualified immunity to apply to statements made to so-called friends or former employees regarding career advice. And finally, the district court correctly followed this court's directive that any potential expansion of the scope and application of the qualified immunity doctrine is a matter for the Minnesota Supreme Court or for the legislature, but not for the district court. This is certainly not the case in which to expand the scope and application of the doctrine. As the court is well aware, the proponent of qualified immunity must show all three elements necessary to establish eligibility for the qualified immunity doctrine. But here, appellants cannot show even one such element. First, Mr. La Liberté's defamatory statements were not made for a proper purpose. And this is not a fact issue. This is based on undisputed facts. As the court has recognized, these statements were totally unsolicited. That's undisputed. It's undisputed they were not provided in response to a request for a reference.
Counsel, is it your position that an unsolicited comment is always foreclosed from enjoying a qualified privilege?
No, not in those instances where the law requires that the information be reported. So, for example, if the employer engages in an investigation into whatever the issue is, and they find wrongdoing, if the law requires that it be reported, whether they were asked to report it or not, the law requires that report.
Like if you're a mandatory reporter of some kind,
yes,
I understand.
Exactly.
All right.
And here again, undisputed, this was not information for which there was a requirement or an obligation to report. Second, Mr. La Liberté's statements were not made for a proper purpose. There is no public or private duty owed by a friend or a former employer to provide unsolicited career advice, nor is there any public interest that's served or promoted by encouraging unsolicited career advice. And third, Mr. La Liberté's statements were not based on reasonable or probable cause. And here again, the facts are undisputed.
Well, how isn't it not similar to situations where an employer can provide information on the character of a former employee? Isn't this in some ways just kind of the flip side of that coin?
I would not agree that it's the flip side, but I'll assume that for purposes of responding to your question. First of all, in this case, the statements were made without a request. So whether it's an employer, former employer being asked for a reference by a new prospective employer, there has to be a request for the information. So even if they're the same, there has to be a request. Here, it's undisputed they were unsolicited. And secondly, as the court's aware and as we've argued, that type of unsolicited information is not protected by this qualified privilege. Even if somehow it could, this theoretical potential application of qualified immunity could otherwise apply, it does not meet the third element, which is it has to be based upon reasonable and probable cause. And here, the undisputed evidence demonstrates the direct opposite. Mr. La Liberté admits these statements were made on uncorroborated hearsay and rank speculation. He admits he had no direct personal knowledge, and he admits he engaged in no reasonable investigation into the underlying facts. In fact, entirely the opposite. The undisputed evidence established that he continued to make and publish these statements repeatedly, even after he was told the information was false.
I have a question, counsel, in terms of, this is more almost procedural, in terms of how we approach this issue.
Mm-hmm.
If I understand appellant's counsel's arguments, I think the approach he's taken is that the threshold issue is whether or not those elements are met, and because it was a motion for summary judgment, we have to view the facts in light most favorable to appellant,
mm-hmm.
and the district court erred by granting summary judgment by basically weighing those facts first without accepting them, and then looking at letting it go forward so we can actually look at whether or not those elements that you're arguing don't apply, whether they apply or not.
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't that the process that should be used?
Two reasons. First of all, the judge held that as a matter of law, the doctrine couldn't apply to this circumstance because the Minnesota Supreme Court has never recognized the application of qualified immunity to this type of circumstance. So regardless of the facts, the request to apply it in this circumstance is barred as a matter of law. Secondly, this court can affirm that determination on the alternative grounds that the undisputed facts establish that the proponent, Mr. La Liberté, had no proper occasion, had no proper purpose, and there was no reasonable cause. So the undisputed facts likewise establish support and a basis to affirm. And I'll offer a third reason, and that is, even if we assume this qualified privilege could otherwise apply to this sort of situation, even if we assume the undisputed facts do not prevent it from being applied in this case, even if it could apply, it is still dead on arrival based on the jury's finding that not only did Mr. La Liberté continue to make and publish these statements repeatedly, even after he knew they were false, but they expressly found these statements were causelessly and wantonly made for the purpose of injuring the respondents. That is embedded in their findings on the punitive damage claims. Accordingly, this provides yet another reason for affirmance, because that is conclusive factual adjudication that even if qualified immunity applied, it has been abused.
So if I could state that just a different way, Mr. Boyd,
sure.
Your argument, if I understand it correctly, is that even if the district court erred in determining that the statements were not uttered on a proper occasion or a proper purpose pre-trial, the jury's verdict indicating that the statements were uttered in a wanton or reckless manner is a factual determination that they were not uttered with a proper purpose or on proper occasion.
And more directly, they were not uttered in good faith, because qualified immunity applies if the statements were made in good faith and the immunity was not abused. Here, the jury found they were not made in good faith, and if there were immunity, it has been abused. And that's not the judge finding that as a matter of law. That's the jury hearing the evidence and making that determination as a matter of fact. And I would note those determinations, the determination, first of all, that these were defamatory statements, and secondly, the findings regarding punitive damages were not appealed. So there's no reason for this court to question those findings.
Can I just clarify, Mr. Boyd? You've answered part of my question, I think, because you were going into the elements, the three elements of a defamation, and your main point, however, is we don't need to get there, or the court properly concluded that this is not a circumstance that's been recognized. So that's number one, and if I understand correctly from your position, our analysis could end at that point. Now, the latter part, when you talk about the jury, are you referring to the malice, where one in the case law seems to suggest from the Supreme Court that only malice is a matter for the jury, whereas the elements of defamation, because defamation is to be determined by the court as a matter of law, when you hear that sort of thing, that's almost seems like that has to be decided first or separate from the issue of whether malice. But was the jury actually given the questions regarding the elements of the defamation?
I believe in one case, with regard to one statement, I believe the district court held it was defamation as a matter of law or per se. The other, I believe it was a matter of fact for the court or for the jury to find. But in either case, whether the court determined that or the jury did, that has not been appealed. So the determination that they were defamatory is not before this court. That's been conceded.
Point, though, about the punitive damages, that relates to malice?
And more specifically, good faith. In the Lewis case, the Minnesota Supreme Court said a communication to be privileged has to meet these three elements when so made in good faith. So you have to meet the three elements, and then it's a matter for, in this case, the plaintiff, to establish those statements were not made in good faith. And clearly here, the punitive damage determinations reflect a finding of not good faith, bad faith, wanton and causeless use of these defamatory statements to harm the respondent, not to help some former employee, but to harm the respondent.
So conversely, getting back to the employer where there is a solicitation, the standard former employer, would you see a scenario, though, where there could still be a fact issue? For instance, let's assume there's some bad faith because of bad ill will between that employee, where that employer gives false information or allegedly false. So you would still get to a fact issue. It fits the circumstance, so it applies. Then the question is whether it was abused or not, factually.
Yes, that's right, potentially. And in this case, they struck, I'm trying to think of the baseball analogy, they had three strikes. One, the law doesn't give them the opportunity to apply qualified immunity here to begin with. Secondly, the undisputed facts demonstrate they can't meet the three elements for qualified immunity. And third, the jury found even if they had qualified immunity, they abused it. So those are three separate reasons for you to affirm.
I have a question on the first one, because yes. The Supreme Court, the Minnesota Supreme Court has indicated that whether qualified immunity applies as a question of law that appellate courts review de novo, mm-hmm. which would seem to indicate, is that where you're going with the first argument? That
yes, and this course, just to build on that, the Supreme Court has said these are the limited reason or limited circumstances in which the doctrine can apply. And then this court has said, and it's for the Minnesota Supreme Court to expand it, not for the district court and not for this court. So that's from this court's own jurisprudence, that it is not for the district court or for the Court of Appeals to expand it. If it's going to be expanded, that has to be done by the Minnesota Supreme Court, and that's what Judge Anderson found or held.
So given that, do you see this as an issue of first impression then for this court?
I would say yes, I would say I'm not aware of a case that has come before this court presenting this particular issue or an argument to have the doctrine applied to this kind of circumstance. But this court has said on many occasions, at least a couple, including that I think it's the Deering case, the unpublished case that Judge Anderson cited to, which cited to prior published opinions by this court, that it is not for this court to expand the application of the doctrine of qualified immunity. It is for the Minnesota Supreme Court. So from that standpoint, it is not a case of first impression. That has been addressed at least a few times and fairly recently by this court.
Mr. Boyd, I did ask your Mr. Buterin if he was aware of any case in any jurisdiction recognizing the application of a qualified privilege in circumstances such as this. Did you find any case that?
No, and I'd like to say this. I know of no case. Now, having
fair.
Said that, I haven't looked.
<Be fair.
laughs> But I certainly know of no case in preparing for this argument. I'm not aware of any case.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. And counsel for appellant, you do have 5 minutes. You may approach and
thank you, Your Honor.
Provide rebuttal.
May please, Court, just a few comments. With regard to the jury verdict, the issue of, I don't know if you can hear me, the issue of malice or abuse of the privilege was not presented to the jury. For punitive damages, the question was whether Mr. La Liberté acted with a deliberate indifference, I believe it is, and that's on question 5 of the special verdict form. And there, I believe, is I don't believe that we can use the district court or the jury's findings with respect to punitive damages in determining any of the issues involved with whether the doctrine of qualified privilege applies in this case. The problem here is that the district court in its decision did not articulate or did not appear to consider the elements of the doctrine to see if Mr. La Liberté had made a prima facie case that the doctrine applies. And that's the problem with, in part with her decision, or the court's decision, I'm sorry, is that it doesn't articulate or show that the elements were considered to make that prima facie determination. I also think that, you know, the fact that the information wasn't solicited, I don't know that that should change the determination of whether the doctrine should apply. It's the elements that have been set forth by the Minnesota courts require the court to apply those elements to the facts before it and make a determination of whether the doctrine applies. Here, the evidence, I mean, the statements were made to one person. They weren't widely publicized. There is evidence that suggests that the doctrine wasn't abused in this instance. And that's all that I have, Your Honors.
There appears to be no other questions. Thank you, counsel. And thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions today and your briefing, and we will now be taking the matter under advisement, issue an order within 90 days. Each have a good day, and happy holidays as well.
Thank you, Your Honors.